Coming to you from our studios in Dallas, Texas, and recorded live, Science News is on the air right now.
This is The Promise of Tomorrow, where people in industry keep up with the business of emerging and nanotechnologies. The fields covered in this series of programs will include energy, defense, aerospace, medicine, semiconductors, and more. For the next hour, Colonel Mason will introduce his experts, and you'll be on the cutting edge of The Promise of Tomorrow.
And it's so good to be with you once again. Welcome back as we explore an exciting world, the business of emerging science, nanotechnology, and open innovation. In just a little bit, we're going to get to today's guest. He's a very fascinating person named Joseph Minervini. I've got to get this right. Minervini. And he is a scientist with MIT in Boston, Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and there's dramatic advances in fusion. So we invited him to come aboard and tell us what's going on with fusion, and that's coming up shortly. And then in the next half hour, we asked Joe what's going on with the electrical grid, because he seems to believe that it's not going to be long before we're going to be changing our electrical grid from AC to DC. And I guess it's going to happen incrementally, according to him. He wants to do it first with the data centers, because they're already accustomed to DC, and other changes like that. I guess we'd have to worry about our current appliances and things that all run on AC. So anyway, that's coming up in the second half hour. So there's nuclear fusion in the first half hour, and that's in the second half hour. And of course, we're going to visit the Den of Strangers, get more wisdom from somebody a lot of us never heard of, and visit our fountain of useless information we have here on the set in the second half of the program. And of course, at the end of the program, listener comments and the voice of reason. Now, before today's guest, we want to step into our world newsroom of the Science News Radio Network and see what's going on and what our correspondents have to say. Okay, remember ClimateGate? That story that we broke here 3 months before the mainstream press way back last fall. This was the weather data that was being kept from researchers and only by a few people at the International Panel on Climate Change, and then later was hacked and found out that a lot of the email information showed or seemed to show that the data was being contrived, or at least some of the data being contrived. Well, now Jonathan Leake of the Sunday Times is reporting that our government, the American government, has suspended its funding of the University of East Anglia Climate Research Unit, citing that scientific doubts raised by last November's leak of hundreds of stolen emails. Oh, and here's a disturbing story out of Washington, D.C. For those of us who follow the medical advances on this program, we'll find this interesting. In many ways it has to do with civil liberties as much as with medicine. I'm going to try to scan this for you. It's pretty long. But you probably remember the Department of Justice directing the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Administration, to not enforce the federal marijuana laws on states that have approved medical marijuana. Well, according to this, agents are conducting raids of homes and businesses where the occupants are acting in compliance with state medical marijuana laws, despite being told by the Justice Department not to do that. According to this report, the agents are storming out of the property of law-abiding citizens with guns drawn, destroying marijuana plants being grown for patients, stealing computers and cash, and then trashing the place. Ooh. According to this report is from the Marijuana Policy Project, a D.C.-based activist organization, and they're saying that a recent raid in Mendocino County, California, targeted a woman who had filed formal paperwork to grow medical marijuana, paid over $1,000 application fee under the local ordinance, and whose operation had been inspected and approved by the local sheriff. Okay, but when informed about this, and this isn't really very funny, I don't guess, the DEA agent in charge reportedly said, "I don't care what the sheriff says." All right. Well, civil liberties organizations and they're joining together. They fear it's only a matter of time before one of these raids ends tragically with someone seriously injured or killed. And the MPP says it appears, one woman, they say, is responsible for the new DEA rogue activities. They're calling it rogue activities. Michelle Leonhart, L-E-O-N-H-A-R-T, became the acting administrator of the Drug Enforcement Administration under George W. Bush and was recently nominated by President Obama to be the permanent head of the agency. Oh, and before we get off that story, here's a side item that's interesting. Apparently, Leonhart has personally obstructed research into the therapeutic benefits of marijuana by denying an application recently from the University of Massachusetts to cultivate marijuana for the purpose of research. All right. And, here's an item in from Australia's Bureau of Meteorology. Tropical Pacific Ocean temperatures continued to cool over the past several weeks and are now approaching levels typical of a La Nina. Sarah Westcott and Mark Reynolds of the Daily Express sent this in to us. Britain faces years of blackouts and soaring electricity bills because of the drive toward green power. A leading energy expert warned this week, a growing obsession with global warming and renewable sources, this is a quote, threatens the stability of our supply, says Derek Bickett. He's a former grid control engineer who has a lifetime experience in electricity and electricity supply throughout Britain. He warned that the cost of the crisis could match that of the recent banking collapse. Woo-woo-woo. All right, now to today's guest. We're going to talk to Joe Minervini. He's with MIT. And as you know, we speak about energy so often on this program because everything leads back to it. If we can solve the energy problems, it looks like we can solve all the problems. And Joe is working very seriously in that at MIT. Welcome to the program, Joe.
Thank you.
Well, it's good to have you. And when you and I spoke offline, you were telling me that MIT is doing some pretty remarkable things with fusion. Now, can you bring us up to date? What's going on with MIT and fusion?
Well, the laboratory here, the Plasma Science and Fusion Center, was started about 35 years ago as an outgrowth of experiments in plasma physics pointed towards fusion research. And it's developed into a fairly significant laboratory on the national and international stage in this field. And we're exploring primarily the concept of magnetic confinement fusion. And that is where you try to recreate the essence of the power source of the sun on Earth through technology that's fairly exciting.
Well, fusion has been, of course, something that we've been dreaming about for years and years and years and years and years and years and years. I'm an old guy, and I can remember back in high school my science teachers telling me that, gee, someday it would be really nice to do fusion. And then Ed Morse, I don't know if you know him or not, he's with UC Berkeley. He's been on the program a number of times, and he says fusion's going to be it. He says, and we'll see it within our lifetime. But when you first told me about doing fusion at MIT, I said, no, it's not. It isn't possible. It isn't being done right at the moment. And he said, well, no, some things are going on with it. So can you get a little drill down for me a little bit on this?
Yes, well, there's been actually a lot of success in the field of magnetic confinement fusion by going to higher and higher methods of confinement. That's we need very high temperatures and we need high densities of a plasma, a hot plasma, and you need to confine it long enough to have fusion reactions occur. And on the sun, that occurs because of the huge gravity of the sun. On Earth, we have to somehow get atoms to fuse together under tremendous pressures and temperatures, something like 100 million degrees, which is actually hotter than the sun. So we have here a working device, which is called a tokamak. It's a Russian name for a type of toroidal confinement facility. And there's actually several of those working around the world. There's one at General Atomics in San Diego. There's a device at Princeton Plasma Physics Laboratory. And then there are newer devices that are recently come online in China, Korea, and Japan's had a fairly long-running program. And now in Europe, there's, besides several machines running there, there's a huge international project that actually started way back at the end of the 1980s, but which has developed over the years into a major international project. Initially, it was just, it was called ITER, for International Thermonuclear Experimental Reactor. It was initially just an agreement between the United States, Europe, Russia, and Japan. In recent years, that group has expanded by adding China, South Korea, and India. And so there's seven full partners now. And they've actually started construction of a really significant major device in the south of France, in Cadarache. It's a very beautiful place near Aix-en-Provence, where they hope to make a fusion reactor that will actually go to ignition. That is, at least from a physics energy balance, create more power by fusion than you're putting in to keep the reaction going.
Well, that was going to be my next question. Actually, I have a dozen questions, but that was going to be a question I was going to get to. But first of all, did you say how many million degree hot electrically charged gas is this, did you say?
It's a hot plasma and made up of isotopes of hydrogen, and it's about 100 million degrees.
How do you contain something that is so hot that it's 100 million degrees? I can't even fathom 100 million degrees. How, you know, what's the container of this thing? What keeps it from going out and burning your eyes, you know?
Well, fortunately, these are so hot that these are called plasmas. They're ionized. So the electrons are separated from the positive charges of the ions, which are the atoms, the central atoms. So for hydrogen, regular hydrogen, there's one proton with an electron circulating around it, and they have a, you know, no net charge. But if you get these hot enough, then the electrons get stripped off from the atoms. And so what you do is you now have charged particles, and you can exert forces on those with the magnetic field. So depending on the direction of the magnetic field and the strength of the magnetic field, I can get these particles basically to be confined in a big magnetic bottle. And that's one of the tricks, is how you shape that bottle to contain it so you don't lose the particles that are flying around at incredible speeds.
Well, Joe, go ahead, I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, the present method, most of the devices that have been built historically use copper windings or magnets to do this, electromagnets. But it's foreseen that to have a commercial fusion reactor, you'll have to use superconducting magnets. And that's what we've been doing for many years, is trying to develop the technology of very large superconducting magnets for fusion energy.
All right, so now what heats this plasma? Is it the magnet that heats the plasma?
No, you need to compress the fuel, so you somehow, if you can force it to be compressed, so you can do part of that with magnetic fields. You can generate an internal electric current that actually flows through the charged ions, and that will heat it through resistive ohmic heating. You can bombard it with neutral particles, so neutral beam sources. You can heat it with microwaves, or you could heat it with lasers. So right now, most of the, for magnetic confinement, that heating occurs through induced electrical currents in the plasma and by neutral beam heating and by primarily microwave heating.
Okay, so you say that you want to make the magnets out of superconductors. Do we have such a thing yet, or are you still relying on the old wire-wound magnets?
Oh, no. We've been developing in a continuous path, superconductors from the early days of making sort of modern conductors in the early 70s all through now. And so the technology of the superconducting material has improved tremendously, and we've been making ever more powerful superconducting magnets of quite large scale.
Now, these superconducting materials, are they carbon nanotubes, or what's the material?
No, the mostly that's been used in fusion so far are what we call the traditional low-temperature superconductor materials. So these are either a alloy like niobium titanium, which is quite ductile, which is superconducting below about 10 degrees Kelvin on an absolute scale. 0 degrees on an absolute scale is Kelvin is all energy stops at that point, all motion stops. So these are extremely cold temperatures. There's also been development of what's called niobium-3 tin. That's a brittle compound that has a higher critical temperature of about 18 degrees Kelvin. And most of the magnets that have been made for fusion have used one or both of those types of superconductors. The trick with those is they're operating in a cryogenic environment, extremely cold. So you now need to keep them cold, and what's really impressive in my mind is that in a large reactor device, you'll have the plasma that's about 100 million degrees in temperature, and within about a meter of that, you'll have these super cold superconducting magnets that are just a few degrees above absolute zero. We are looking more recently at high temperature superconductors, and high is a relative term. Our temperatures, they're superconducting below about 100 degrees Kelvin. But that's a big difference from a thermodynamic standpoint between 100 degrees and, say, less than 10 degrees. There's much greater ease in making devices that can contain devices at, say, the temperature of liquid helium, which boils at about 77 degrees Kelvin, than there is for liquid helium, which boils at about 4.2 degrees Kelvin.
These temperature extremes sound like they're really dangerous. I mean, is there a lot of danger involved there at MIT? Is this right on the campus at MIT? Is that where this is taking place?
It is on the campus. We have several buildings of laboratory, one with a cell, an experimental cell, which houses our device. It's called Alcator, which is derived from Alto Campo Toro. There is a professor here, Bruno Coppi, who coined that term years ago, which is Italian for high field torus. And there's been a series of these devices. But this one, I mean, there is danger in the sense that there's a lot of high power running around. There's microwave heating going on. There's the cryogenic cooling that's going on. In this case, they're copper magnets for Alcator, so they're cooled, they're subcooled with liquid nitrogen, but they're not superconducting. And there is a danger of some radiation because there is a slight amount of activation in the cell, so it is a thick-walled cell. But there is no danger like you would imagine in a fission reactor, which, by the way, we have one just a few buildings over down the street from my office. Is a 5-megawatt nuclear fission reactor, and in that you can't, because it's so hard to confine the plasma and heat it, that it's extremely easy to have the reaction stop. So breaches of the vessel that's holding it are actually quite benign. There's no stored energy to speak of, which would do any damage to anyone.
Well, how do you create electricity from this process, this fusion that you're talking about? I mean, I understand how it does with fission. Creates a lot of heat. You boil whatever water there's going to be. It goes to turbines and creates an electrical current. But how do you do it with fusion?
Well, actually, you do it exactly the same way. You have to somehow get the energy that's released from the fusion reaction to come converted as heat, which you then use to heat water to make steam and turn a turbine and then your electric generator. So the way this works is you actually have two components of a fuel. As I said, it's based on isotopes of hydrogen. So hydrogen is that you would normally see is one proton as in the atom. But it turns out that in nature, there's an isotope called deuterium, which has a proton plus a neutron. So it doesn't change its charge, but it doubles the mass. And that occurs naturally in seawater, the deuterium. Now, if you have another isotope called tritium, where you have the proton plus two neutrons, that's the other part of the fuel. If you can force those together somehow, and that's why we use the high temperatures and pressures and magnetic confinement, what you'll get is a helium atom, which has two protons and two neutrons, and that extra proton comes off. And between the energy that's released in forcing these together, we have to remember energy is mc squared, so we're changing the mass just very slightly. You lose maybe 38 parts out of 10,000 as a fraction of the mass. So that energy comes off, most of it carried by the neutron. And what you need to do is around this plasma, now the neutrons are not charged, so they'll go through almost anything. They're massive and they're carrying a lot of energy. And what you do is you have to have some type of a blanket around it, which absorbs the neutrons and converts that into heat in that process. And then you have to take the heat out through some fluid outside the reactor vessel, and then you would have another heat exchanger where you would have water on that side, and then you would make steam and turn your turbine. So it is rather complicated. It's a little bit more difficult than boiling water. It's a complicated way to boil water, let's say.
Well, I guess that's the reason that explains why we've been trying to do it for 50 years or more and haven't been able to do it. And the other question is, if you're going to all the trouble to heat everything up to 10 million degrees, why not just use that heat to generate electricity instead of going to the bother of worried about fusion in the first place? And then the other question is where's the payback? Aren't you spending more money and energy creating this fusion process, as you had mentioned before, than the actual energy that you're getting for the process?
Well, let's take those one at a time.
Okay.
First of all, we do have this, quote, 100 million degree temperature, but it's an energy caused in a very low density plasma, okay? So there's not a lot of energy stored in it, even though they're moving around at an incredible speed, these atoms, these ions. Okay, and as I said, how would I get that energy out? Because I can't put it in contact with anything, any fluid or any metal, because it's too hot, it would melt it.
Mm-hmm.
So by basically having the reaction that generates the neutron and brings energy release through this change of mass of this reaction, the neutron is basically the carrier of the energy, which I can then absorb and get the heat out.
Okay, Joseph, I need to stop you here. We're about out of time for the first half hour, but when we come back, I'm going to be interested in knowing the answer to that question. I mean, are we spending more energy in creating fusion than fusion is actually producing itself, and is that the big reason why we haven't been able to have fusion low these many years? And also, I'm going to want you to tell us about how soon it's going to be before we're going to be changing over from alternating current on the electrical grid to direct current. I understand that there's some real utility in that, although it's something that has never been able to be done. I mean, what was it? Edison or Westinghouse or one of them wanted to do it years ago, and it was impossible to do for some particular reason. Anyway, most of our appliances now, like our computers, are all rigged for direct current. We got to change alternating current into direct current, so why not just send the whole thing direct? And I think you have some views on that we're going to want to hear. Also, we're going to visit our Den of Strangers in just a minute here, get more wisdom from somebody a lot of us never heard of. And in the next half hour, we're going to visit our fountain of useless information we have here on the set. And we're going to ask the spirit, I think, something about a cat bear or something like that today. I'm not sure. We'll find out in just a bit. And, of course, at the end of the program, listener comments and the voice of reason. So we'll be right back in just a minute. Okay. As we walk to the break at the half hour, we're going to pause at the door of the Den of Strangers, where we keep locked away all of the wisdom of mankind. Who in the Den of Strangers will we meet today?
Soren Kierkegaard. Most men pursue pleasure with such breathless haste that they hurry past it.